Välkommen till Freuds Toolbox, skolans inspirationspodd med fokus på känslor, relationer, lärande och ledarskap. Tillsammans med Kenneth Freud får du inspireras av och lära av nationellt och internationellt ledande experter på evidensbaserat lärande och ledarskap.
Hi everyone. In today's episode, we will talk, it will be a complex talk, I think. It will be a bit about the science of learning, and it will be a bit about behaviors and what we should do in our schools to succeed with our students in general. And to do that, I found a really interesting guest. He's the founder of Research Ed. He's, I would say, an expert on student behaviors and classroom management. And he is the author of two interesting books that I read. One called Running the Room, and one is sort of a complementary one, Running the Room Companion, that I enjoyed reading and will connect a little bit to in our talk. And because of that, I could say, welcome, Tom Bennett.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be welcomed. Good to be here.
I think we will start a little bit with Research Ed. I have never participated myself. I heard a lot, I talked to colleagues, I read a bit about it, but what is it really?
Okay, well, this is shocking that you have never participated in it. I can't remember. Okay, Research Ed is, it started off as a series of conferences, and it became conferences that started to run throughout the world, really. And it became kind of a community of people who care about research, who care about evidence, who care about teaching, who care about children, and who think that these things should all talk to one another. Because when I started to be a teacher in about, 2003 maybe, in the UK, what we did as teachers was very un-evidence-informed, and we tended to make things up as we went along, and if you ask somebody for some advice, they might give you good advice or bad advice. And, you know, that was okay up to a point. But I realized that a lot of what we did didn't seem to have a very much cognitive psychology or credible evidence base to inform it. So I started Research Ed. I put an event on in the UK, and it was all crowdfunded and crowdsourced, and nobody got paid. It was all volunteers, including myself. And it sold out. And we brought together teachers, but also researchers and academics and budget holders and people involved in policy, just to talk and talk about what evidence means to them in education. And it grew and grew and grew. And now we run Research Ed in, I think, 16 countries. And the national conference we have in the United Kingdom, we have 2,000 people coming. Wow. And it's been incredible. So that's what Research Ed is. And a very short history of it, but it's grown much broader than I could ever have imagined. And we never intended it to be like this. I think it just wanted to happen. I think people were hungry
for evidence. Feel a need of it then, I guess.
Yeah, I think there was a need. I think that education, up until even, say, 15, 20 years ago, was very much like medicine was in the 18th century. You know, it was based on folk medicine. It was based on some of it superstition, some of it tradition, some of it intuition, some of it you know, credibly observed research, but a lot of it not. And I think that's why education was hungry for this type of change, and educators who come to these conferences, they, you know, you can see the light go on in their eyes and think, why didn't we discuss this in our teacher training?
That is so interesting. So I need to participate for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Please come along. I'm sure we'll have one in Sweden again. We've had them in Sweden for the past 8 years or so. I don't think we're having one this year, but next year we'll probably have one, I'm sure.
That's very good. And I think this is really important. There are so many books out there about how to teach, and there are, like, say, about evidence-informed teaching strategies, but when I read, I find so many that is not based on how our brain learn. I think it's difficult. It's difficult to sort of teach
That's
and not.
why.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
No,
No.
sorry. That's why I try to. We try to make Research Ed a kind of an honest broker. That
Yeah.
we try very much to make sure that the people who are talking there are relying and leaning into very credible evidence bases, and they're not making wild, fantastical claims based on, you know, what's going to make them rich, or you know, something they very passionately believe in. I mean, that's great, but you know, passion doesn't make you right, and I think that's what education has had a big problem with. That the interesting thing is that now everybody wants to be called evidence informed, because everyone has realized that it's a good thing to be evidence informed.
Yeah, true.
But everyone wants to be evidence informed, so sometimes people now just say, you know, here's this crazy idea I have, and it's evidence informed, but then they don't show you the evidence,
no,
which is what a magician does. So we try to avoid that.
Yeah, that's wise. Let's talk a little bit about behaviors then. In your book, Running the Room, you say that behavior is a curriculum. Can you sort of explain what you mean by that?
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. It's interesting because, as I said to you before, that a lot of what we did in education was very intuitive, very maybe traditional. We did things because that's the way we did them.
Yeah.
And again, this is what doctors used to do before science started to come into medicine. And if I can just stay on the research angle for 1 second, because it's relevant to behavior.
Yeah.
Initially, when science started to become a credible field in like the 18th and 19th centuries, that doctors initially resisted this. You know, doctors initially said, how dare you? How dare you tell me what to do? I know my patients. And there was this belief that simply because I'm a professional, I have status, I must be right. And it was very much like a priesthood. You know, it wasn't so much that they knew what they were doing. It was their, how dare you question me? I'm a doctor. And I remember there's a great story. I think it's often quoted about Semmelweis, and it's the idea that when in one hospital, I think in Germany, when lots of women were dying from after childbirth, and they couldn't quite work out why, but they realized that the midwife, the children who were born with a midwife, the mortality rate was much lower, but when doctors delivered the babies, the mortality rate was much higher. And they figured that it was something to do with the fact that doctors used to dissect corpses. And so they would have all these cadaverous particles on their hands, you know, lots of bacteria. And then they would deliver a baby. And when the doctors were faced with this knowledge, they would say, how dare you? I'm a gentleman. My hands are clean. You know, it's this idea that I'm special.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why I'm saying this is because not only does it relate to the entire field of education and what we had to do to fix it, but also to behavior management.
Yeah.
When I was a trainee teacher, there was no training in behavior management. And I thought that this was just something to do with me, that I was very bad at it, because I had a very bad time with my classes when I started. And I started when I was a grown-up. I was 30 years old, so I was already, you know, fairly confident, and I liked talking to people, and I love children. But it was still awful. And I taught in inner-city London. And I realized very quickly that I'd never been trained how to manage a class.
No.
That there was this strange expectation that, oh, you'll work it out as you go along. But of course, most people don't. And many teachers struggle with behavior in their classes. And I know that in Sweden, this is the case for many teachers also. Not, of course, not every teacher, not every class.
No. No.
Same as the UK. But as I started to travel the world looking into behavior, I realized that this was universal. Every country had this problem. Every country had this issue that teachers weren't too sure what to do. So I looked into the subject quite closely, and I found that, I mean, there's lots of things we can do to get good behavior, but there's a lot of bad advice out there. And one of the worst pieces of advice is, oh, you just have to build a relationship with your class. And the reason why that's bad advice is because it's true, but it's not good advice because it doesn't tell you what to do. Building a relationship is not an easy thing. And also you have to know what to do, which is why I came up with this idea of the behavior curriculum. I realized after a few years of looking into this, that children aren't born knowing how to behave in a classroom. Classrooms and schools are institutions. They're complex places. There are lots of different things to do to be successful there. And some children aren't born, in fact, no children are born with the ability of knowing how to behave in a classroom. That if they're lucky, they come from an environment, maybe a home, where their parents or their families or their peer groups patiently explain to them, this is how you wait. This is how you speak up for yourself. This is how you shake somebody's hand. This is how you use knives and forks. All of these basic customs that we often take for granted, you and I perhaps, because we can do them. Children have to learn them at some point. And children who are less fortunate don't learn these things very well at home. And they come to school, and it's not their fault, but they don't have these socialized skills and habits of behavior that help them to succeed. Behavior is learned from your environment. And if it's learned, it can be taught. And if it can be taught, then it can be a curriculum. And this is why I think behavior is a curriculum. Because if we want to manage behavior, one of the most important approaches that we must take is to see it as something that we teach to children.
Yeah.
You know, welcome to this environment. We care about you. We love you very much. We want you to be successful. And because we care and want you to be successful, we will teach you how to walk down a corridor, how to behave in a classroom, how to behave when you're stuck, what to do when you're upset. You know, lots of different behaviors, but ones that will help them to be successful. And I think that's the key here. We teach the behavior curriculum because we care about them, because we want them to be successful. That was a long answer. Sorry.
No, it's good. If we connect to that in your book, you also write, teach, don't tell behavior.
Yes.
I have some citations that sort of just get stuck in my mind. I can't sort of forget them. So I like that quote, but what's the reason for that quote?
Well, if you, many schools have got rules, you know, expectations, you know, we want you to do this. And that's a good thing, because what we need to do is to have a clarity for what children should do to be successful in a school environment. Because if you don't give them that clarity, some of the children will succeed because they've already been socialized. They already have these habits of, you know, turning up and trying their best and being polite to people and waiting in queues and so on. All this normal stuff that we do to exist and to succeed.
Yeah.
But if you're not clear about these expectations, then some children just don't know what the expectations are, or they have their own expectations. So it's important to have clear expectations. You know, we walk on the left or we walk on the right or whatever. It doesn't, I don't really care. But telling people isn't enough. You know, you can tell somebody not to smoke, but it doesn't mean they're going to give up smoking.
No, true.
Or not to vape, I should probably say. I should update my metaphor.
Yeah.
You know, or I could tell you how to drive a car. If you don't know how to drive a car, I can tell you how I do it.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't mean that you can do it very well afterwards, because telling somebody is an important part of teaching, but it is not the whole thing. And this is an interesting thing, because people like you and I, and maybe a lot of the people listening to this, they know a lot about teaching and what, you know, what we might call pedagogy. I don't know if that fits particularly well. And once we understand that, that teaching something is different from just telling it, it involves reflecting, meditating, and checking they've understood, revising, repeating, incremental steps of learning. You know, there's the basic bricks in the wall of learning. Then we understand that if we want to teach behavior, it's not just as simple as giving children a list of things to do and saying, do that, because it's much more complicated than that. We have to teach, which means we might teach the children the routine for how we want them to enter the room. But then once we've taught it, we then check they've understood. We quiz them. Or maybe we get them to demonstrate. Right, show me how we're going to enter the room. Yeah. And then I give them feedback.
Yeah.
And then perhaps we try it again. And this is a normal pedagogical coaching, teaching cycle. But we apply this to behavior. And we do this particularly, pardon me, at the beginning of our relationship with children. And it's a way of helping them to be successful.
Yeah. If we connect to that, something, other thing interesting you also write is that make it easy to behave and hard not to. But could you It could be difficult also, because can you sort of connect that to Bjork's desirable difficulties, because that is sort of a balance.
That's a really interesting point, because a lot of what we've learned in cognitive psychology about learning anything also applies to behavior too. Now, desirable difficulties is an interesting thing. It's something I haven't explored too deeply in my work, but I do have some thoughts on it, which is that initially, when a novice approaches a subject, the very first thing you want to do is to give them the tools with which to enter the domain of the knowledge. So if you want a child, a small child, to be good at calculus, you know, trigonometry, they have to understand algebra.
Yeah.
So you don't start with trigonometry, you start with algebra. But hang on, algebra, if you want someone to understand algebra, you have to start with arithmetic. Okay, good. But you don't start with arithmetic yet. If you want someone to understand arithmetic, you teach them to understand basic number relationships or number bonds, we might say. And if you want them to understand that, we have to start with understanding numerals, numbers, so numeric recognition. In other words, when you want a novice, a complete novice, to start a new topic, you begin at the beginning.
Yeah.
You begin with simple things, key terms, foundational concepts. It's the same with behavior. If you want someone to start getting good at behavior, you start talking about things like, you know, really simple stuff like, this is how we enter, this is how we leave, this is what to do when the bell rings. Simple but important stuff to begin with. As children become more familiar with these routines, we can start to talk more about more complicated routines. You know, like, for instance, what to do if you see your friend is upset, what I want you to do if we see a fight, you know, how do I want you to respond to this, what to do if a friend is being cruel to you. You know, these are more complex behaviors, and we can start to build upon the previous ones. But in terms of desirable difficulties, you don't want too much difficulty too early on.
No.
You want just enough challenge, a very thin layer of challenge on top of what they can already do, in order to keep promoting their growth.
Yeah.
So when I say we want to make it as easy as possible to behave, it means exactly that. We explicitly teach and we remind students what to do.
Yeah.
So before they need to do it, before they need to pack away, we remind them of the behavioral cues. So don't, in 1 minute, we're going to pack away like this, just to remind them. Yeah. But eventually you get to the point where you no longer give them that cue.
Yeah.
You take away the scaffold. Yeah. You take away the training wheels on the bicycle, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, to see how they cope.
Yeah.
And if they cope, you keep on doing it again and again. So I think that's the layer of difficulty that we introduce.
Yeah.
We're essentially scaffolding them to become independent.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen by itself. It happens very carefully.
Yeah. I think that is important comments. I think people sometimes misinterpret desirable difficulties, so it becomes undesirable difficulties.
Absolutely.
So you
don't want them to give up.
No, but you want them to feel successful.
It's a very skillful part of a teacher's craft.
Yeah, yeah.
Knowing exactly how much and where and when not to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. I try to connect this about behaviors with the science of learning again, because it's interesting. You also write about routines and habits that are important from many perspectives, but maybe could you elaborate a little bit about why you write about that from a behavior perspective, but could you also connect it to sort of the working memory and to learning in general?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's completely connected. I make this point in my book that the learning behavior, I mean, we know a good deal about learning. You know, psychology has been studying learning for many decades now. It's probably one of the best evidence and researched areas in social sciences. You know, how do we learn? And it's madness for us not to lean into this. And learning behavior shares many things in common with learning mathematics or tennis or lots of things. You know, how do we learn something? Something is learned when it moves from the short term to the long term memory. And behaviorally speaking, this is also true, that I can drive a car now, and I do so fairly automatically. You know, I don't have to think where does my hand go? You know, I just drive.
Yeah.
But when I started to drive a car, everything was conscious.
Yeah.
I remember my wife will tell you that so I learned to drive when I was 17, but I didn't drive for 15 years. And then I met my current wife, and I started to drive again. And at first, even after such a long period of time, I couldn't remember most of driving. And I would literally say what I was doing. Yeah. I would say things like, I'm going into second gear now, I'm going into third gear. And it was so annoying. But I had to kind of verbalize it to conceptualize it, until eventually you do it so often, it becomes a habit. Yeah. You know, the synapses form in your brain between the neurons, and you have this kind of this pathway of expectation, this habit, you know, that one thing will follow another.
Yeah.
In the same way that you might have a habit in some cultures, if people clap, you start clapping too. It's just a normal thing that you do.
Yeah.
If somebody puts their hand out to shake their hand, you do the same thing automatically. It's just a habit.
Yeah.
Or someone sneezes and you might say, bless you, or Gesundheit, or something. So habit formation, behaviorally speaking, is very similar to this process, that we want children to repeat the actions so frequently in school.
Yeah.
Like the actions of how they come into a lesson, or how they leave a lesson, or maybe putting their hand up to ask a question, or whatever, you know, whatever you want them to do.
Yeah.
They do it, you make them do it so frequently that it becomes habitual. And it goes from short-term to long-term memory, and it just becomes an unconscious action. It's just what they do. It's closely connected to the concept of conditioning to some extent. Only in this example, the conditioning is useful, healthy, and positive. Like the conditioning we have to stop when we get to the edge of a busy road, when we're walking along the pavement. You know, that's good conditioning. You know, that's not something I want to take away from somebody. I want somebody to automatically stop then because they think, I should stop.
Yeah.
Or a driver stopping at a red light. So often this phrase conditioning has very negative connotations. But in reality, it's essential for us to cope with existing in a complex environment.
Yeah. But in this case, isn't it so that it's good for behaviors, but it's at the same time, it's also good for academic learning in itself, because you release pressure on the working memory for the students that they can focus on the content of the lesson instead?
Well, yes, because I mean, I think cognitive load theory, as Dylan Williams says, is probably one of the most important theories for any educator to understand, because it's so well evidenced in research, but it's so useful to the educator. And also, and this isn't always a good thing, but it intuitively feels right, which I know can be a bad thing, because in education, if something feels right, it can lead you the wrong way.
Yeah, true.
But it just, I think it makes sense to many people that we've only got so much space in our head to think.
Yeah.
But we do have this vast unconscious that can store memories and habits and so on. And that's what we want to try. That's what we want to try and utilize. We want to make sure that as much as possible is going into the long-term memory, the unconscious habitual memory. And from a learning point of view, this is why chunking is such a useful concept. You know, the idea that you learn lots of things, and then once you've learned them well, so well, in fact, that they're habitual, then you can chunk them and put them together. And a good example of that is driving the car.
Yeah.
At first, driving a car is like flying a spaceship. You know, there's so much going on. Oh my gosh, I have to do it all at once. I'm overloaded. I can't think of everything. I can't reverse my car with the radio on. That's quite a common thing. A lot of people turn the radio off when they're reversing because they think, I have to think now. And that's to do with chunking. Whereas once you know how to drive, someone can say, drive the car, and you do it. But until you can chunk that, it's you're thinking about the little pieces, the components, the bricks. But if someone just says wall, you remember the wall.
Yeah. Another thing that is important for learning, and I guess also for behaviors, is motivation. Do you have ideas how you can work with motivation in the classroom to promote behaviors? Yeah.
I mean, motivation, you know, broadly speaking, is either the conscious or even a vaguely subconscious desire to do something. You know, to be intrinsically motivated towards something.
Yeah,
is probably what I might call the holy grail. You know, it's yeah. the it's the thing we're all trying to get in education. We want children to do the right thing because they want to do it. They're doing it naturally.
Yeah.
And intrinsic motivation is very important. But so too is extrinsic motivation. This idea that sometimes the motivation to do something comes from outside of us. Yeah. Somebody makes us do something. You know, we see a speed camera, so we slow down. We see a yellow line. In the UK, we have yellow lines on the road, which means don't park. I don't know what the Swedish equivalent is. Or a teacher tells you, you know, you must finish this piece of work, or you can't leave the classroom, or something like that. Some kind of extrinsic motivation. Or you go to a restaurant and you want to buy the steak, but you can't afford the steak. You know, your financial situation is an extrinsic motivation. And we use both in classrooms. And in order to build intrinsic motivation, we use extrinsic motivation as well. So if you want children to be motivated to do the right thing, like come in and work hard and do your best and so on, I would say that, first of all, we make it easy to behave. We make it clear what they have to do. We explain why they should do it, because helping to understand somebody why something is useful or good will be a good way of motivating them. It doesn't work with every child, but it helps. And we try to do everything we can to help. And then we habituate the children into just doing something automatically. And that starts to develop a sense of intrinsic motivation. I'm going to do this because it's just what I do. But we also use little points of pressure from outside the teacher. So it might be something as simple as, you know, you look right into a student's eyes and say, I need you to get started. Now that's extrinsic motivation. But of course, it's not magic. It doesn't make them do it. But for a lot of children, that will be enough. If an adult stands next to you and says, please get started. Or you mention it again, or you perhaps you make your tone a little bit more serious, or you walk towards the child, you know, or even you might say there'll be a penalty, or you can't leave the classroom until you're finished, or I don't want to have to phone your mother, and so on. Or maybe you offer a praise or encouragement or help or a reward of some kind. And there's lots of ways of creating motivation intrinsically and extrinsically. But one of the most powerful ways of doing it is by trying to tune in to helping the children understand that if they behave the right way, they'll get something that they already want. And if I can refer to Maslow slightly here with his hierarchy of needs. Now, I know that Maslow is not what you might call the hardest of science. It's, I think that a lot of what Maslow says about motivation is very useful.
Yeah.
And I think that in other ways, it's been quite credibly researched. You know, he would say things like we're very motivated by the desire to achieve food and warmth and shelter and safety and so on. And I think that not many people would argue against this. The higher levels of Maslow are not very well researched. In fact, Maslow's research at that stage wasn't very good. But I think it's a useful model.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he states there is that people automatically are very drawn to being safe, but also having status, mattering to other people, feeling like they're worth something. That sense of love and belonging is very important to most human beings, unless you are a psychopath or a sociopath or Donald Trump. And one of the things we find is that most children want to be quite successful. You know, they want to do well.
Yeah.
But in a classroom environment, they might think, well, I'm going to make my friends laugh. I'm going to be the center of attention, or I'm going to make the teacher look stupid, and that will make me look better. So there's lots of bad ways they can achieve this status and meaning and so on. So we have to say really clearly to children, look, I want you to be safe in this classroom. I want you to be successful in this classroom. I'm going to look after you. I'm going to look after everyone. Everybody here matters. You can do really well at this subject. And most children, if they hear that, think, okay, that could be interesting. Yeah. Some children think, wow, that's great. But it's a way of helping to get the children to understand that the reason why we want you to behave in a certain way is to get all that good stuff and that this is good stuff that you probably want. Yeah. And it's a really useful way of helping children to understand that the reason why we are telling them to behave in a certain way isn't because, you know, we hate them. It's not because we like to tell them what to do. It's not because we like to boss them around. It's because we want them to be successful.
Yeah.
And that that reaches a lot of children. And may I just say that particularly reaches a lot of children who come from very troubled backgrounds or very difficult backgrounds or have lots of maybe mental issues. They need to feel that somebody cares about them. Yeah. And that's why I think that having a safe, calm classroom or school is fundamental to everything we're trying to achieve here. It is a basic human right, and it's our duty to provide it for them.
Yeah. If you compare to the sports area, one of the strongest motivators for most athletes is progression. I mean, I've been like an athletics coach for many, many years, and I could have a group with very different capacity, but everyone are together, and as long as they feel they develop, they are happy, and they can have a lot of desirable difficulties then, as long as they feel progression. You can
sort of, I couldn't agree more. Yeah. I think that we often, I haven't really spoken about academic pedagogy very much here. No. Because of what I thought was more behavior. I think that all these motivations are connected. Yeah. And I think we often forget how joyful it is to realize that you've got better at something.
Yeah.
Perhaps even especially when you're not very good at it to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean, my daughter is learning piano. Yeah. And she's been learning piano for a couple of years. And she's now grade one. And she can play a tune. You know, it's nice. It's, you know, it's not just notes anymore. It's a tune. It's a melody. It's a you know, accompaniment and harmonies and so on. And you can see it in her eyes that she loves that. She loves that she knows she can do this now. It was very hard to begin with. It wasn't fun.
No.
But it became more satisfying as she realized this. And if you show a student their work, you know, you literally hold a student's book up in front of them and say, look where you were in September. Look where you are now. And you can see it in the student's eyes. Oh, I can now do, I don't know, long division.
That's powerful.
Or something, you know?
Yeah. Connected to Maslow, in your book, you also write, biology eats culture for breakfast.
Well, there's a famous quote, isn't there? That culture eats strategy for breakfast, which, you know, roughly speaking, means that the habits and the habits and motivations of a child, that they bring with them from their lives, will very quickly undo any big plan you had for them. You know, so you might think, something like, oh, it's going to be great. The kids are going to love this lesson. You know, I've planned this really brilliant lesson.
Yeah.
But if you've got children who come from environments where they don't like learning, they think it doesn't matter, they don't care about you, you know, all of that will be destroyed. Culture eats strategy for breakfast. But my kind of version that I've added on is that biology eats culture for breakfast. That if you're tired, and this isn't a new idea, just a different way to phrase it. If you're tired, if you are hungry, if you're upset, you know, if you are, you know, if you're sick or whatever, you know, that biology really matters to all of that culture too. So if a child comes, even a very nice, well-behaved child comes into class, if they're really tired, they'll be more grumpy, less focused, they'll find it harder to learn and so on.
Yeah.
If a child has been up playing on the PlayStation 5 all night, you know, it will affect how they behave the next day. And that will have an even bigger impact on them. But if a child is feeling threatened or scared by another student in the class, then that will dominate their thinking and their motivations. It doesn't mean they will behave badly, but it will be a huge factor in how they behave. So that's why educators need to be particularly careful to work with parents and try to teach them to, for example, make sure their children get enough sleep.
Yeah,
and it's such a simple thing, but it's so important to what we're trying to do because it affects everything else. And also make sure that children have got access to, and again, it sounds obvious, but make sure children have access to water. Make sure they've got time to eat their food. You know, you can't make them miss a lunch break or something like this. And also understand that at the end of the day, they'll start to get tired. So maybe adjust the tasks that you do. After lunch, they might be a bit sleepy as well because their body is digesting. So that might be part of what we have to think about too. So we always have to think about biology. And I remember this very, very closely because I used to be a teacher on what we call in the UK the Duke of Edinburgh program, which is a, it's kind of a program for children at school where you take them at weekends camping and they learn forest craft and they learn to read the stars and so on. And it's really, really, it's a great thing for children to do. It's been running for decades now in the UK. And whenever you take children on a 20-kilometer expedition, you know, you can see their bodies getting tired and then picking up again. And so you stop and have a rest. And if they eat too many sweets, you can tell when they've run out of sweets because they crash. And all of this, you know, because you're very in tune with the body at this point.
Yeah.
And I think we need to have some of that more into the classroom environment. We need to think a lot more about where are their bodies right now?
Yeah.
You know, is there something in the environment which is affecting them? And it might be something like a stuffy classroom. You know, if levels of carbon dioxide get too high, you naturally start to become more sleepy.
Yeah.
Which is why we should, you know, open the window. Something as simple as this. In fact, I know some schools that have got carbon dioxide monitors on the windows that automatically open the windows when the level goes too high. I mean, I think that's a bit dramatic. I think we can just open a window naturally.
Yeah, that would be enough.
But, you know, you don't need technology for this, but it's worth thinking about.
Yeah, so if you're successful with behavior in the classroom, then you have really good basic conditions for academic learning to happen as well.
Yes.
Social development. But
you're absolutely right. Basic conditions.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I often notice is that when I go to maybe like a private school or a school with children who are very, very well conditioned to behave, you know, it's not always to do with wealth. But it's a big factor. And you go to a school where the behavior is great, and sometimes the teaching can be very, very boring indeed. And by boring, I just mean weak. You know, it can be very low levels of challenge. It can be very low levels of pace, very low levels of expectation. Yeah. But the thing is, the teacher can get away with this because the behavior is so good.
Yeah.
And I think that when the behavior is good, you then have the basic condition for children to do all these amazing things, you know, to work hard, to learn, to talk, to thrive. But until you have good behavior, until then, everything else will be worse. Everything else.
Yeah, that's true. But the next step then, I mean, you want thinking to happen in the classroom, not to have students just imitating. So how to, I mean, thinking is sort of also an important condition for learning to happen.
Yes.
So the idea is, how can you, if based on now we have good behavior, how can you promote thinking in the classrooms?
Yeah. Well, this is very connected to motivation. It's also connected to this magical concept of engagement. You know, we know that when students are engaged with the learning, they do better. We know this is quite foundational.
Yeah.
But what does engagement mean? Well, obviously, it doesn't mean being quiet necessarily, although that helps. And it doesn't mean looking like you're being busy, because you can be busy doing something useless.
Yeah.
And Professor Rob Coe at the University of Durham is very, very good. He writes very well on this. He calls these false proxies for engagement, things that look like you're engaging, but you're not actually engaging. And he's absolutely right to say so. When it comes to the classroom environment, once you've got reasonable behavior, you know, once children aren't surrounded by all these enormous distractions, we now have to think about, well, what does it mean to engage? Now, the mistake many people make is to think, well, engaging means it has to be exciting. It has to be funny. It has to be humorous, or it has to be fun. And I'm not against humor or fun or excitement. You know, these are great things too.
Yeah.
But you cannot generate these things automatically. You know, if you have to teach a child trigonometry, you know, I mean, you can wrap it up in fun activities. You can make games and so on. And that's fine too, up to a point.
Yeah.
But the problem is then eventually the game starts to drown out the learning. And all that we remember from the activity is the game.
Yeah.
And this is encapsulated by the famous quote that memory is the residue of thought. We remember what we think about. And Professor Daniel Willingham is very good on this topic, this idea that, you know, if the lesson is all a game, then all they remember is the game, because that's what they've been thinking about. Okay, so what do we do? Well, again, it comes down to pedagogy. We introduce a subject as simply as possible, but no simpler. We talk about the topic, and then we make sure that the child understands before we move on. And this could be a very simple mastery model. And we give them high quality feedback as to what they've just done. And that helps them to understand how to get better, which means they start to feel empowered that they can get better. Yeah. At the same time, we also use positive praise, you know, but not too much. Because if you use too much praise, nobody values your praise anymore. So you might say to a child, that was good. Look at that. You worked that out all by yourself. That's the first time you've done that. Well done. A little bit of praise like that, but sprinkled constantly throughout your conversation. It teaches the child that they matter to you, that their learning matters to you, that they've done a good thing. You scaffold it for them to some extent. So there's a combination of good pedagogy in terms of academic cognitive practice, but there's also a combination of pedagogy in terms of how we speak and encourage people.
Yeah.
And one of the things I've often observed, and this can happen with the least able of your children, is if they realize they've got better at something that they didn't think they could get better at, you can see a small bomb go off in their head of realizing that's nice.
Yeah.
It's, I'm not sure pleasurable is the right word, but it's satisfying.
Yeah.
And life is very much about doing things which are satisfying, which are meaningful. And and to know that you've done better at something, perhaps especially when it was hard to begin with, is very satisfying.
That's interesting. I have actually only two questions left.
Oh, we're doing so well.
Yeah. One question would be, if we talk about behaviors in the classroom, if you would like to give the listeners a few takeaways, sort of the some keys to think about. Don't forget this. Focus on this to to help
yourself. Sure. Gosh, you put me in the spot. But okay, some really basic but very important fundamental things to remember about behavior is that children need to be taught how to behave. That we cannot expect them to know what you mean by good behavior. Yeah. They're not telepathic. And also, children are not as good at the behaviors as we are. You know, you and I can have a conversation like this for an hour because we are adults with maturity. We're both interested in the topic. We've got high levels of self-regulation and so on. But children may not have these things. And so we have to make our behavior instructions very clear, very explicit, very concrete. Give examples. Be very detailed. Repeat yourself over and over again. And when somebody gets something wrong, try to correct their behavior, first of all. If somebody deliberately repeats the misbehavior and they know what they should be doing and you've explained to them what they should be doing, then there must be some kind of consequence for that action. Now, I know that sometimes many Swedish teachers struggle with this because of what they are permitted to do, what they are not permitted to do.
Yeah.
But I'm here to say this. It is very hard to run a challenging class without some level of consequences and boundaries.
Yeah.
And if a child, for example, is rude to another child, then that child needs to have some kind of penalty for it. If they attack somebody else, if they're rude to you, if they throw a pen across the classroom, there must be some kind of consequence, which doesn't mean everything's about sanctions, but it means that we have to have sanctions. So that must be part of the repertoire, and schools must have that. And if they don't have sanctions, then they're causing a big problem for their teachers. But also, try not to forget that repetition is your friend, that by constantly repeating yourself with classes, that eventually the majority of them will understand what they should be doing. And also don't forget that for a lot of children, once they realize that they're learning, that will help them to understand that this is a good thing and they should be doing it. If they can learn that learning is meaningful, that being part of your classroom is meaningful, that they belong to your class and that they're valued in the class, that's a very big motivation for them to behave. But that doesn't mean that teachers should accept being treated badly themselves. You know, I'm a very, very big believer in clear boundaries for children. And if we remove those boundaries, then children think, I can do as I please. And that's a disaster.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and the final question. Let's say you will change your role a little bit. You will become the principal of a totally new school. So you will recruit all the staff. You can decide the profile on the school. You can do anything you like to. Yeah. What would be sort of the profile, the important things for your school to be successful?
Oh, from a leadership perspective, yeah, that's fairly easy. First of all, I need to decide what I mean by good behavior.
Yeah.
A lot of teachers and leaders focus on what is bad behavior. And that's important. You have to. I would start by thinking, what do I want my children to do in the canteen, in the corridor, in the classroom? You know, what does good behavior look like? I would write this all down. I mean, I would make sure it's clear. And you could have, you know, you could have rules for equipment or uniform if you want to have a uniform or whatever. You know, you could have rules for anything you want, as long as it's clear. I would then turn that behavior curriculum into a behavior training policy. I would then train the staff in this. I would turn it into training. I wouldn't say to staff, good luck, I hope the children behave. You know, tell me if they misbehave. I would say, here's what the children should be doing. I would then teach the staff what I want them to do. So there would be a training day for the staff. And that would mean things like, here's what I want you to do at the beginning of a lesson, at the end of a lesson, in the playground, in the canteen, in the corridors. You know, I would make it clear what their expected behaviors were too. I would then get the staff to teach the behaviors to the students. And so there would be this constant feedback loop of, we all know how we're going to behave with each other. You want to build a relationship? That's how you do it. You teach the conduct expected of two or more parties. And then once I'd done that, I would then also have a very clear consequence system that the students would understand and the staff understood and knew how to use, which would involve things like very mild penalties, but also rewards, but also encouragement and praise and reminders and cautions and phoning in parents and sometimes suspensions. But all of these things would be part of the policy and everybody would know how to use them. And then finally, the glue that holds us together, I would train my leaders, my managers, how to make sure that on a daily basis, not every 6 months, but on a daily basis, they were checking that the teachers were doing what they should be doing. And this is what we call line management. And this is what being a manager means in a school. It's not about meetings and administration, although that's part of it too. The main job of a line manager is to line manage, which means managing a member of staff, making sure they're upholding the school behavior policy, the school behavior curriculum. And then I make sure that they are doing that on a daily basis. Now, that might sound like a very, very simple model. And of course, there's lots of other things, like we bring parents in, we communicate clearly with all of the stakeholders. Yeah. But those are the main things. If you start with that, it's the best way to begin. But if you don't start with that, you end up with a very chaotic environment where everybody is doing things differently. A school is an institution. Yeah. It's not a group of friends who are telepathic. It's an institution, which means you have to have institutional systems in place. And I think this is the key thing here. It must be run on systems. You can have exceptions, you can have judgment and so on, but the system must exist first. And that's what I would do.
Great. That was really interesting idea. I think a very good idea as well.
Because I hope so.
It summarizes the whole talk. And really good final words. And thank you so much. This has been a really interesting talk for myself and for sure for our listeners.
It's been a huge pleasure. It's been lovely to speak to you. And hello to everyone in Sweden. It's an absolute pleasure. I hope to come over again soon.